by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with Charlotte Littlefield. Charlotte is off tonight. We've got really a fine guest with us this evening. Gosh, from the West Coast, he's written a fine book, Behold a Pale Farce. His name is Bill Blunden, and I'm going to let him explain a little bit about his background to you. Welcome to our program, Bill Blunden.
Thank you for having me, George. It's great to be here.
Boy, I tell you what, tell our listening audience out here in Austin, Texas land a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book.
Well, I started off as a student in physics got out in originally 1992, realized that there wasn't much demand for physicists, and ended up going into the computer field. Went back and got a master's degree in operations research, and eventually got a job with a vendor who does enterprise resource planning, which is basically business software on a vast scale. Did some R&D for them, and then moved out to the West Coast where I worked for a number of companies and eventually got into the security field. And from there I developed an interest in, rootkits, which are basically tools that can be used by an attacker to maintain a concealed presence on a machine that they've compromised. I published a book on rootkits several years back. As this occurred, I started hearing stories. A narrative started to develop in the news about cyber war. And there were other metaphors too, that you could hear, something like, Cyber Katrina or Electronic Pearl Harbor or Cyber 911 or, Cyber Armageddon. And I looked around at these metaphors, and I looked at the events that were actually happening and, what was happening and what was the picture of threat that was being painted. And I noticed that there was a dissonance between the two. They didn't necessarily add up, and it looked kind of funny. So I got interested in that and kind of looking at the difference between what we were being presented as a picture of reality and what was actually happening. And I was approached by a publisher in about 2010. He said, I'd like you to write a book on cyber war. Are you interested? And initially I said no, and he was persistent. This is a publisher in the Bay Area. They say that, when a child is lost, if they choose the adult to help them, they'll probably be okay. But if the adult chooses them, then it's not as good a situation. And I think it was similar with me. I think the publisher came and chose me. And, it ended up being a kind of a bad situation. After about 6 months of work or so, the publisher, the chief editor, called me in, and he told me that him and the owner had reservations about the tone of the book. The coverage that it had of former director of national intelligence, Mike McConnell, they were particularly concerned about that. And then he was saying there are certain parts of the message that I had that he couldn't sell. He was obviously every publisher is concerned about that. But one thing that stood out was he mentioned something about they were worried about the 2012 presidential election, and that's when the alarms kind of went off. And it was a few months later that eventually we dissolved our relationship. I ended up trying to go find another publisher. And I found one. It was Chris Milligan up in Oregon with Trine Day. And having looked at some of the books that he's published, and he's written forewords to some of them, so I got to read who is this guy, and you know, he had some videos on YouTube that I could watch, and I could see who Chris Milligan is, and I decided this is the guy I want to publish with. So I approached him. Eventually, we started a project. So, and I've never looked back. It's been, you know, it's been pretty steady since then. So, it's been a wild ride.
You know what really impressed me, Bill, about your book? It has a really natural flow to it. Okay, it's like sitting in a living room around a fireplace, you know, and talking to you about these matters.
Yes.
But some of these matters are very serious, are they not today? What's happening in the country?
Absolutely, it is serious. The book, I would say, it flows because there's been 4 years of effort put into it. So after the polishing the stone.
You have a natural flow there to as far as talking about the different topics and the way they fit in. And what's really good is about the examples that you're giving. And you give what I see there is you're street smart and you have your feet on the ground and you've done the things you're writing about.
Right. It's definitely a data driven book. And you were saying this is a serious problem, and
yes.
I would agree that it is serious. And the problem is some people just they don't necessarily understand this is a serious problem. They say, well, you know what, you know, I've got nothing to hide. Why should I care if the NSA is reading my email? You know, why should that bother me? Because, you know, like I said, I've got nothing to hide. And what these people don't understand is that these civil liberties are safeguards. Anyone who's lived in China back in the days of Mao Zedong when he was conducting his cultural revolution, or anyone who's lived in Russia while Stalin was in power, understands how important these civil liberties are, especially when you suddenly don't have them. And I think that to an extent, the U.S. is starting to show signs of a similar illness, where we have these things happening in secrecy, these decisions about our civil liberties and the extent that they can be transgressed, decided by secret directives, which are then opinions occur in secret by secret judges in secret courts, and on something that we can kind of actually see. There's also the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act. There are detainment provisions in that act that allow the military to detain a U.S. citizen without a trial indefinitely on suspicion of terror-related crime. And you have to understand the way that they've defined this. It makes it very dangerous for journalists and for activists. The fact that they're now under a risk of being detained, depending upon how this is interpreted. And I believe it's being contested by a group of people, including Chris Hedges and Noam Chomsky. But I think that this is a sign of what's happening. I think as matters stand now, we exist in a surveillance state. I'm very convinced of that. You know, the powers that be now have the ability to monitor and analyze things, almost everything that's happening in real time, and watch everything, every kind of online transaction and phone call, everything. And to think that there's nothing more than a series of secret policies to protect us from this, from devolving into a police state, I think is really pretty reckless. We put all the machinations in place for a police state, and to assume that this policy decision is going to protect us if the time ever came where people decided that's what they were going to do, I think it puts us in a very dangerous position. I think it's been very risky for us as a country to do something like this, and then to assume it will never get worse, and somehow this will never be abused.
Right. You say in your book that, and I'll just list off these dangers, and you really spoke well about them just a few minutes ago. Warrantless wiretaps, corporate data silos, national security letters, security courts, secret laws, secret interpretation of public laws. I mean, this is developing to a very scientific, surveillance state, has it not?
Yes, we have. It, like I said, if you talk to the people who testified, like William Biney, his assumption is you just have to assume that. And this is another point that is echoed by the owner of LavaBit, a company that was shut down. He'd rather shut his company down than give away his private encryption keys. They both said just assume that they're capturing everything. This is a pretty. This is something that's been developing for decades, and it's gotten to the point where they do have the ability to basically capture everything. And you should just make that assumption. There's a lot of debate about what the extent of it is, but when you have someone like William Biney saying, just assume they're capturing everything, that's pretty much a safe assumption to make.
Right. A while back, there was a report, a special report by Dana Priest and Bill Arkin. I think Washington Post
yes.
reporters, Top Secret America.
Yes.
Did this reveal how extensive a whole system of top secret managers that we have out here exists today?
Yes. It's getting larger and larger. Top Secret America. Dana Priest, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and Bill Arkin. Both put out a pretty amazing project that shows you the extent of this kind of this hidden government and how it's sprawling and it's getting bigger and how these decisions, a lot of decisions about it, are just you know they're made in secret and we're not involved with it and it's kind of grown out of control. Secrecy it hides a lot of things. It conceals things in order for a republic to function. You know, a functioning democratic republic. You know, we have ostensibly a republic. In order for it to function, you have to have citizens who are well informed and who are thinking rationally and using sound judgment, essentially. So the problem with all this secrecy is that it undermines our ability to have this information and to make and to be involved and engaged and make decisions and participate. So I would say that secrecy is probably one of the primary threats right now that we face. It's antithetical to democracy, because people need information in order to participate and make decisions. And so they're being excluded from that process by secrecy. And this whole secret side of government is getting bigger and bigger. And so I think it really is a threat to the republic.
Right. You state in your book something about Booz Allen, which is a legal firm in the Washington, D.C. area, having a tremendous contractual agreements with the federal government into the billions of dollars. I've forgotten exactly the figure. But Carlyle Group is very a large owner of that particular law firm, I believe.
Yes. Booz Allen, it's one of those companies that has over the years kind of developed channels to our government, and it has its there are people there who have their hands on the levers of power. This is one of the elephants in the corner that people aren't thinking about, and that is that. It's not just government surveillance that we need to worry about. It's also corporate surveillance. And people, you know, think to themselves, you know, the corporations can't come arrest me like the government can. Why should I be concerned about this? But I think what people need to realize is that there are reasons for these corporations, these business interests to cooperate with the government. For example, as far as the national security state is concerned, the dividing line between the public sector and the private sector is basically nil. Something like 70% of intelligence work is done in the private sector. So there are financial incentives for them to give a hand when they're asked or even to cooperate preemptively. For example, Amazon recently signed a $600 million contract with the CIA to provide cloud services. Microsoft also has signed a $617 million agreement with the Department of Defense. And in 2013, Lockheed made something like $23 billion in revenue from government contracts. But it's not just the financial incentives that drive these companies. A lot of them, especially the social media companies, have legislative needs. You know, they make their money by monetizing user data. In other words, they spy on us. And they sell our data to other companies. And So they have legislative needs to dilute privacy laws because the more data they can collect, the more money they can make. And finally, there are in-house security sections to a lot of these companies, and they proactively share. And this isn't anything new. When Ralph Nader was investigating vehicle safety, General Motors hired private investigators to go dig up stuff on him and to look into him and try to entrap him. And the fossil fuel industry, they have a long history of targeting activists, environmental activists, and they have dedicated sections in their companies to do this. For example, when Bank of America was worried about WikiLeaks, they were directed by the Department of Justice to a law firm called Hunton and Williams. And Hunton and Williams, in turn, and the law firm did this because it can kind of protect itself through client attorney privilege. They'll use a law firm to do this. The law firm itself, Hunton and Williams, went out and found three other tech companies, Benrico, Palantir, and HB Gary Federal, basically a goon squad. And they planned to take on WikiLeaks through a campaign of disinformation. And by applying pressure to journalists, which is kind of spooky in and of itself, they said, we're going to make Glenn Greenwald have to choose between his career and supporting WikiLeaks. And eventually this was disclosed through attack by Anonymous on HB Gary Federal. And this came to light. But it shows you what can happen. You know, these corporations, they also have their own internal security sections. And so they have these reasons to cooperate, these financial incentives, these legislative needs, and these security sections which want to cooperate proactively. And so it's very rare when you have a company that won't cooperate, like Lavabit. Lavabit, you know, the owner is very ideological and say, hey, this is wrong. I'm going to resist. I'm going to fight. And I'd rather throw everything away than give you one red cent's worth of cooperation. But otherwise, for the big companies who have these huge contracts and have legislative needs and these private, you know, security sections, for them, they make the cost-benefit analysis and they decide it's definitely worth cooperating. This is dangerous because the scale of what goes on in the private sector dwarfs anything that the government does. And this is something a lot of people don't realize. The data broker, data aggregator market is something like $200 billion a year. It is massive. And to make matters worse, this is a business sector which in many cases values profits over privacy. And I'll give you an example. For example, Yahoo. Yahoo has been known to – it's been documented that Yahoo has cooperated with the Chinese government to help them track down people who say things derogatory about the government. And these people have been jailed and in some instances tortured. And then there's other companies like Microsoft. There have been reports that have come out that Microsoft has altered Skype so that governments like Russia can decrypt and analyze the sessions and listen to traffic as these conversations are occurring. Their whole mindset is different. They're not necessarily focused on our civil liberties. They're focused on their fiduciary duty to generate profits on behalf of shareholder value.
Right. Wolfgang Schmidt, you're quoting in your book, a former lieutenant colonel of the East German Stasi, made the following remark regarding the mass interception systems being leveraged by U.S. intelligence. Here's a quote directly from him. You know, for us, this would have been a dream come true. So much information on so many people. End of quote. Boy, that is something insightful. Stasi, yes. Right? East German.
Yes. I mean, someone like that telling you, I'm impressed. There's definitely something to
worry about. Right. Gosh. I tell you, and where you're so thorough in your book, too, is that you see what comes through the liberty and freedoms that you talk about and that you really care about very deeply, don't you?
Yes. And what bothers me so much is that they're telling us that they're doing this to protect us. They're doing this to protect us. In other words, we're undermining your liberty so that you can be safe. And this is, I think, a real problem. This whole idea that you have to give up liberty to get security. It's an argument that's been made by a well-known pundit who has op-ed columns in the New York Times. His name is Tom Friedman. And about a year ago or so, he wrote an op-ed piece called "Blowing a Whistle," and his his idea was, well, you know what? What we should do is just. I'm okay with this surveillance, and the reason I'm okay with this surveillance is because I think we should sacrifice a little liberty, because if we can't protect the next terror attack, this next attack might very well be so bad that we end up having to give up all of our freedoms. So it's better just to give up a little bit upfront and save all, the rest of our liberty, because who knows how bad the next attack is going to be. So we need to prevent it. And there was enough outcry. It's very interesting to watch how this happened. There was enough outcry that shortly afterwards, Bill Keller, the former editor of the New York Times, wrote an op-ed specifically citing and supporting Tom Friedman. The name of the piece, I believe, was Living with the Surveillance State. And what you see with a common thread that you're seeing with these two, both of the op-ed pieces, is that they're both saying, essentially, we need to undermine the Constitution to save it. And it almost reminds me of Iraq, where they were like, we need to destroy, you know, there were arguments made, we have to destroy Iraq in order to save it. And it's a ridiculous argument. But even our founding father, Ben Franklin, thought this was ridiculous and an awful decision. He said that those who would give up essential liberty on behalf of a little temporary security deserve neither liberty nor security. And I would agree with him. I don't think that it's terrorism that erodes freedom. It's our response to terrorism. Back in England, when they were being bombed by the Germans, the government would put these signs, and they would say, remain calm and carry on. And I think as a country, that's really what we need to do. We need to remain calm and carry on. And I think if you want an example of how this is done in practice recently, look back to Japan when they had the nerve gas attacks by the Aum Shinrikyo. They didn't. When these attacks occurred, they didn't suspend constitutional rights. They didn't institute mass interception. They didn't torture people. They didn't rely on indefinite detention. No, they had criminal investigations. They investigated the people involved. They charged them, and then they tried them in a civilian court. And they didn't go crazy. You know, they remained calm and they carried on. And I think that's really how we need to respond. That even leads to other questions like, you know, does this mass interception even protect us from terror? You know, and I think that there have been claims by credible people, and this is almost part of it's a propaganda technique that's you know, been around since the days of Eddie Bernays, and it's called the third-party advocacy technique, where you take a credible authority and you have them give a claim. For example, Mike Rogers, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, and General Keith Alexander, who's still currently I'm not sure if he's switched over yet, but at the time he was the head of CyberCom and the director of the NSA. And both of these men, Alexander and Mike Rogers, claimed that there were 54 instances in which mass interception prevented or disrupted terror attack. And so people started looking into these claims. And after enough questioning by in Senate committees and, you know, Obama's NSA review board and even the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, and there have been other studies too. There's a guy at Ohio State named Mueller who's looked into this extensively. And what these groups and these people who decided to scrutinize this claim found was that they failed to identify a single instance in which mass interception had actually disrupted or prevented a terror plot. I think the closest they came was some cab driver sending some funds to another country. And so this is really disturbing, and it brings up questions like, you know, is this just an imaginal line? Is this just a useless, you know, big, expensive boondoggle? Or maybe it's mission creep. Maybe it's an instance where capability is driving policy. But I think that if you want to know what it's really used for, I think Ed Snowden has actually talked about this. In an open letter to Brazil, he said the major goals of this mass interception are economic spying, diplomatic manipulation, and social control. And I think there's definitely – it's about power, in other words. And I think there's definitely a lot of evidence to support that.
What I see in Great Britain right now, the 11 Hume Trust is funding into the hundreds of millions of dollars the big data research. and development program over there. And they have a lot of this information and data, but to manipulate it and to cultivate or cull out what they need is not that easy. What are your thoughts or comments on that?
Well, I think if they're having a hard time now, it's just a matter of time. They just need to put more resources into it before it becomes useful to them. There are already companies like Google that have developed stuff that's interesting enough to the government that they've developed these relationships, and so these solutions will exist and be provided a lot of times by the private sector. For example, in 2003. The Google deployed for the NSA some of its search technology for $2 million, and then in 2010 Google won a no bid contract for $27 million for its Google Earth technology. The government was interested in that. Said, hey, let's this Google Earth stuff, it's interesting. Let's enter it in contract and use it and take advantage of it. And then in 2012, the Department of the Interior entered into a contract for $35 million with Google. So you can see that there are these links developing between the private sector and the public sector. And so the private sector will eventually provide solutions if the government doesn't arrive at them independently. And there's these tight links. I think that despite the anti-NSA PR blitz that has been recently executed by Google, the company is still linked heavily with the defense industry. They have links to companies like SAIC, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, and Blackbird. And to give you an idea of how intimate these companies are and with the government and how extensive the links are, there was an email that was published by WikiLeaks. It was written by Fred Burton, who's a former State Department official and also a VP at Stratfor, one of the companies that was hacked by Anonymous, and they got a hold of their email. And in this email, it is something supposedly he heard from Eric Schmidt. Burton talks about the director of Google Ideas, Jared Cohen, being out on these secret trips to the Iranian border with the support of the White House and the State Department. And you think, what's going on here? What is he doing out by the border? Why is he doing it at the behest and with the support of our government, with the White House and the State Department? It's really odd. You realize how extensive these relationships are and how a lot of it is actually secret, as Dana Priest and Bill Arkin kind of revealed in their book.
Right. We're seeing Keith Alexander, General Keith Alexander, attend Bilderberg meetings. And along with Google representatives, and I believe, Yahoo last year, I believe, the lady that represents them was at that meeting, I believe. So they're all synergistically coming together. It looks like this geospatial is providing much of the hardware infrastructure through satellite systems, which is the third largest building, I think, in Washington, D.C. area now that they occupy. I think you could put the Statue of Liberty up inside the atrium, according to some reports. But, I mean, just from the base of the feet to the top. So it's a large building, but it's the third largest building there now. So they're behemoths. I mean, they're becoming overwhelmingly. You've got government that can supply some of the infrastructure, and then private enterprise, what has much larger enterprises than many of these countries are operating in. So it's becoming very, very powerfully money-driven, right?
Yes, and you see, like Snowden said, what is this mass interception is actually good for? And on an aside, these Bilderberg groups, they're definitely disturbing.
Right.
Unfortunately, we can't stop rich guys from getting together and talking. So we have to meet these people at the level of government where the decisions are actually executed and implemented. So I think that a lot of people will focus on Bilderberg, But I'd say, you know, rich guys are going to get together and talk. There's not much you can do about it. You got to meet them on the playing field in the government, because that's really what they're subverting, is the institutions. But anyways, to go back, you know, we had this massive level of cooperation between the two. And then, so what's it actually being used for? And, you know, like Ed Stone said, this is about economic espionage, diplomatic manipulation, and social control. And if you look abroad, there's plenty of evidence to back that up. You know, the U.S., the NSA has watched oil companies in Brazil and in the Middle East. They've tracked money transfers, transactions through SWIFT. They've watched people at economic summits and environmental summits. And at home, there's also the same dynamic that's kind of occurring, social control. And that should set a few alarms off. And there's, you know, we have a government where the president, you know, this for the first time ever, sits down, looks at the list, and decides who to kill. And they have this drone program which goes off and kills crowds of people, in sometimes based on nothing more than a vague signature. And we have these torture sites all over the planet. So the idea that it's somehow out of bounds not to monitor political activists or maybe even union strikes is, and somehow that's out of bounds, it doesn't make any sense. And again, there's evidence to back this up. In 2009, a report emerged about how the U.S. Army, in conjunction with other agencies, were watching and infiltrating anti-war groups in Washington. In 2013, the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security released documents showing that they had been, with the cooperation of local law enforcement and some corporate security units, had been watching the Occupy movement and kind of monitoring and trying to infiltrate them. And even where I'm out here in the Bay Area in Oakland, there's something called the Domain Awareness Center that the city has put in. And initially they sold it to the public as a crime prevention measure. But as documents have been released about this, activists have shown that this is not so much about preventing crime as it is about you know, monitoring nonviolent political action and labor strikes. And this again shows you that the lack of dividing line that's going on, I think, between the private sector and the public sector, and how there's an element of social control here. It's not necessarily about anything to do with terror. They're watching a lot of normal citizens. It's not just the hunting for a needle in a haystack.
Right. Is there a difference between, I know the European Union had a study on the echelon system years ago that I read.
Yes.
But I mean, they're still on a distribution basis, I know, out of NSA. Yeah, you've got the tier one, I believe is UK, United States, UK, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. But I think, recently some of the Snowden stuff revealed that they're distributing to most of the European Union also. Now this thing in this recent scandal in Germany, what do you say about that? And I know Merkel raised hell, so what were they even spying on the German upper level on the cell phones? Is that what NSA was
doing?
Well,
I think that, you know, people in other countries, they're really no limits and they have no rights as far as our government is concerned. It's a free game. There are basically three legal provisions cover this. There's Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which is kind of like the business records provision, which has been used to get at our metadata, our phone metadata. And there's Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which allows them to intercept phone calls or communications that originate within the United States and then are destined for outside the United States. So if you're talking to someone outside the country, and they even vaguely think that this person might be a terrorist or somehow this is terror-related, or they think maybe you're a terrorist, they can listen to that call without a warrant. And then for everything else, outside the U.S., it's free game, and that's basically based on Executive Order 12333. You know, the people – Snowden has indicated, you know, that even though there are these legal provisions that are ostensibly limit collection within the United States, he's hinted that there are informal agreements where the intelligence agencies will share with each other. So in other words, there's no limits to what we can collect in other countries. The NSA can get everything, and oftentimes it does get everything. And so the same thing, I think, the same sort of dynamic exists here, and that is that other countries can listen without any sort of legal constriction in the United States. So it makes sense that the two countries could swap data. You know, I collect data in your country, and you collect data in my data, and we'll just swap data. And that allows them to sidestep these legal provisions because the NSA is not collecting the data. It's the GCHQ.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And so that's really kind of ominous. They're able, you know, whatever barrier we're going to set up, they're going to be able to sidestep. I think it really kind of represents almost a political problem. But I think, you know, regardless of how we get upset about the NSA here, you have to understand that people in other countries, you know, they're now in a situation where they're watched. Everything they do can be watched online, and there's no accountability and there's no limits. And I think if we were, you know, if the U.S. knew that you know, there was another country that was doing that to us, I think we would go nuts. So I completely sympathize with how Germany is responding. I think they should be even more critical and vocal about this. But I think that because of their economic ties with us and their political ties with us, that Merkel, there's kind of limits to how far she's going to go.
Right. I think they've been operating, according to Wayne Mattson, out on top of the embassy there in Berlin. They've operated some kind of interception system, you know, of site. I was in West Berlin in 1965 with the Army Security Agency.
Really?
Yeah. There's a Teufelsberg, a mountain of rubble in western part of, west of the Olympic Stadium in the Grunewald. And I worked up there for a year, with the Army Security Agency. And so I had sort of a little bit in my 20s, early 20s, I got a little taste of we reported to the NSA daily, okay? That's who our chain of command was. But then it was strictly foreign intelligence and interception stuff, but we did nothing inside this country. The danger is that we're taking the NSA and we're operating inside this country. That is the danger to everyone.
Yes, and I'm surprised Merkel I'm surprised they haven't balkanized the internet even more. There's already been talk of countries kind of saying, well, you know what, 90% of the internet traffic is going through the United States. That gives them a huge home field advantage. So why don't we start building parallel structures so that we can kind of control our own backyard, so to speak. And the people who have made noise about this tend to be the business sector, the corporate entities, because it means that the rules are going to change for them, and they don't like that. They like everything. They need it, like things to be as cheap and as consistent as possible. And so they complain about this. Oh, we need to keep the internet open, you know. But if you look at this from another country standpoint, it makes sense. You know, it's like, hey, you know, this is our country. We have to have, you know, more control over the traffic that's going through. We don't like the idea of another country listening to everything that we do. And this thing stand now, the Executive Order 12333 really kind of gives the NSA free rein and the CIA too.
What would your comments be on the recent giving up of control of the internet, so to speak? What exactly happened there? Was it just naming or the icon or what? Explain that to our listening audience a little bit more from a professional viewpoint that you have.
Well, the idea is that organization, is it an American organization? Who's it going to answer to?
Right.
And so by making attempts to give other countries kind of more say in the matter, this is all, the internet is really an American invention, and the ICANN kind of reflects that. And I think that this bothers other countries, and so their moves to kind of, to give other countries a little more say in what happens and how this entity operates. So I think that's a kind of an initial step. And obviously there are concerns, you know, that people have put forward about countries like Russia or China basically using this balkanization process as a way to enhance their own control of their own populations, and you know, there's we face the same problems, you know. I think that this is, technology can go either way. It can enhance democracy or it can enslave. And so it can be used to spread information or it can be used to spread propaganda and, you know, manipulate people and watch them and control them. And so it really is a political issue. I think it's not just a technical issue. There are political issues that here's at stake. And that's another thing that people just don't realize. They think that you can just solve this with a new application or a new technical approach. But this is also a political problem. There are political issues here that define things too and define the problems that we face.
Right. Are you familiar with Cass Sunstein and some of his writings about cognitive infiltration, stuff like that? I think on the 9/11 issue, he was the communications czar, I think, in the White House for a while. And his idea was to go in and infiltrate some of these so-called groups, 9/11 truth groups, and then undermine them. But I think he's just launched a new book, and I believe he launched it at the Constitution Center in Philadelphia. So, his whole idea is antithetical to freedom, and launching the book in Philadelphia in the Constitution Center, that just doesn't seem right to me.
Yes, there have been plenty of projects where the U.S. government will either troll social media or they'll actually go in and disseminate propaganda. I believe that recently in the National Defense Authorization Act, there's sections which allow now propaganda to be disseminated here in the United States. And so there was one project called Operation Earnest Voice, where the military was disseminating propaganda through social media. And the propaganda actually has a very long and storied history in the United States. It goes all the way back to World War I. That's really when you can kind of, if you historically you want to go back and say where are some of the origins of modern U.S. propaganda, you'd say World War I, because Woodrow Wilson had been elected to office second term on a platform of peace. And the saying was that he kept us out of war. And unfortunately, he found himself in a position where he decided, well, you know what, this country does actually need to go to war. And so he has to do this dramatic 180-degree turn. And he's thinking, oh, how am I going to do this and get these people who voted for me to support the decision? So he formed something called the Creel Committee, and he got a journalist named George Creel to head it. And the goal of the Creel Committee was to generate and disseminate propaganda to get the United States whipped up into a frenzy so that they would support the decision to go and engage in World War I. And one of the people on the Creel Committee, his name was Edward Bernays. He is the father of modern public relations. He actually coined the word public relations. He coined it because he said he wanted to avoid the stigma of the word propaganda. But essentially, public relations is synonymous with propaganda. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he borrowed some of his uncle's concepts. He believed that humans had these subconscious, deep, animalistic urges, and if they had to be controlled. So the way to do that was to give control of society over to a technocratic elite who would then make the decisions so that we could avoid the problem of humans, you know, and their animal instincts taking over. So we need to have a reasoned approach to government. And so we need to engineer consent by the elite and then use propaganda to convince the population to go along. And he was influenced heavily by another journalist of the era who also was involved with some of these activities. His name was Walter Lippmann. Walter Lippmann was one of the founding editors of the New Republic magazine, among other things. For example, he participated in a quasi-intelligence outfit called the Inquiry during World War I to help Wilson draw up post-war plans for the United States and the rest of the world. And Lippmann believed that basically decision-making, these issues in terms of the day-to-day political issues, were too complicated for the average person to understand and appreciate. And so he said he kind of had, you know, It's similar to Bernays. In fact, I think Bernays was probably inspired by Lippmann. Lippmann said that because these things are so complex, we have to defer to a small group of responsible people who know what they're doing and let them make the decisions. And then we bring the rest of the population along with propaganda. And he called it manufacturing consent. And so that explains why Bernays called his approach engineering consent. It's the same idea. Fundamentally, it is elitist democracy. Where we don't believe that the normal public is fit to govern. So we need to have a small group of people do it and then get everyone to come along with us. And so it's not surprising that this is still ongoing because, you know, this is back as far as World War I. Bernays went into the private sector afterwards and helped corporations sell products.
Yes. Advertising, right? There was a Watson that came out of Johns Hopkins, I seem to recall. I don't forget the first name, but he was a leading advertising executive, yes, on Madison, yes, Avenue in New York. He came right out of Johns Hopkins, which that behavioral psychology was a basis for some of that earlier advertising. It seemed. What would be your comments?
The links, you know. The links, once you get out in the private sector, like I said, I talked about how heavily linked the public and private sector are in terms of the national security state.
Right.
It turns out the Bernays would go right back into government when the government wanted to overthrow, Guatemala on behalf of United Fruit. I think that he was involved in helping to paint the government as being a communist leaning government. To give us justification and pretext to go back in there and overthrow Guatemala. And so, again, he went in the private sector and he went right back. When the public sector needed him, he'd go right back in and help them, you know, sell their agenda. And it's still active today. We're still, I'd say that this whole cyber war campaign, it's basically a propaganda campaign. You know, nobody knows what these pictures of cyber Armageddon. Nobody knows, you know, there's no quantitative, there's no statistical data. So it's very hard to make a prediction. And yet the people who are creating painting this picture of a threat are acting like they can predict it. And furthermore, they're focusing on all the negative consequences. And what this tells you, this is kind of their tell, they're giving it away a little bit, that their message isn't intended to appeal to reason. It's there to induce an emotional response. It's there to kind of make us viscerally respond. And this is the hallmark of threat inflation. And it's a propaganda technique. It's a PR technique. The idea is that you take a small threat and you blow it up so it looks like a huge threat. And we saw this in Iraq when Bush was talking about smoking guns that come in the form of a mushroom cloud. That's threat inflation in action. And it stokes anxiety. It puts us into a crisis mentality. And the problem with that is that in a crisis mentality, you'll pay any amount of money to be safe. People are scared. They're anxious. They feel like they need to take some sort of action. And they're susceptible. And they'll hand over a lot of money. But just because there are lots of types of insurance doesn't mean you need to go out and buy all of them. A rational person doesn't pay any amount of money to be safe. They only choose insurance carefully in deciding what their exposure is, you know, what their cost benefit and what the risk assessment is. And then they decide cautiously, carefully, deliberately. But when you're in a crisis mentality, you don't do any of that. And you know, society is in a situation where it could waste a lot of resources and give up its civil liberties to protect itself at a very high cost. And in doing so, ignore problems that are actually probably more serious and more tangible and more concrete. I think there was an intelligence officer from England who said, well, are we going to remake our world to face one threat? And in doing so, neglect all the other threats, which might be more serious. And so I think there's definitely something to be said about that approach and the hazards of this threat inflation distracting us. And you might ask yourself, why is this threat being inflated? You know, why is this picture being painted? And I think that since the disillusion of the Soviet Union, The defense industry has been struggling to maintain strategic relevance. You know, they, during the Cold War, they had this huge budget. They had all the status in the Beltway. They need to find new reasons. They need to find things to sell, things to ensure growth. Recently, that would be cyber and drones. Those are two growth industries as far as the Pentagon and the defense industry is concerned. There was a book, a former CIA officer's named John Stockwell. And the title of the book was In Search of Enemies. And that's really how I would typify this. We're in search of enemies because the military's got a budget that exceeds $500 billion, and it's massive. It's double what, you know, well over double what the Chinese spend. If you took everyone else in the world and you combined their defense budgets, it would be more. We spend is more than that. And when you ask them, you know, why is this? Why do we spend so much money? They're going to whip out, you know, vague terms, suitably vague terms like national security or national interest, things like that. But the truth is that this budget, you know, well over half of our discretionary budget, it channels money to a small group of people who just happen to have their hands on the levers of power in D.C. And I think, you know, that I think explains a lot of it. It really is a way of kind of managing that money and funneling it to certain interests, certain business interests that have traditionally been this way since World War II. You know, when World War II stopped, the CEO of General Electric talked about a permanent war economy, and that's really kind of what we have.
Do you see the left and the right coming together because of their fear for loss of freedom and liberties? Do you see that both sides now are beginning to wake up? Or can the public wake up properly? Are they waking up?
That's a good question. Part of it is we have this, you know, the people in the establishment, the people who are in power, they have relationships with our media, the corporate media. You know, the media is a corporate media, and this corporate media, it has something to sell. It sells the eyes of its readership to the advertisers, who are also big companies. So when you have the buyers and the sellers in the market are both corporations, the business, the interests that often get put forward are those that cater to the buyers and the sellers, meaning corporate America, and they benefit from what's going on. And so it's difficult. I mean, it's obviously with Snowden revelations, it's hard to keep this truth from coming out. But it still gives voice to people like former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta or even Barack Obama, who will say, well, you know what? I think that, you know, they'll say that, well, you know, this is, we don't do warrantless wiretaps. We don't spy economically or this is all about stopping terror. And, the evidence proves that they're wrong, that they're lying. And so I think there's a crisis of trust. I think that this mirrors what happened back in 2008 when banking executives said, you know, don't worry, deregulation is going to be okay. You know, the Commodities and Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which deregulated the derivatives market, you know, that's going to be fine. Don't worry about that. And Glass-Steagall, we don't need it. And these, oh, by the way, these AAA mortgage securities, they're perfectly safe. And it turned out they were all lies. And so, again,
right,
we're confronted with these lies. And so I think that people are coming together, but they're faced with something, and that is they're faced with this propaganda technique called the big lie, and that is that they're told lies that are so bold that you would look at this, especially a credible, you know, political leader or official who's telling you something, and you couldn't believe that they would have the audacity to look you in the eye and lie to you. But that's exactly what they're doing, and it harkens kind of back, I think, to the Pike Commission.
Some of these foreign intelligence committees and stuff like that.
Yes.
They're some of the worst in Congress that I've seen, you know.
Yes. What happens is the Department of Defense, they can't co-opt everyone, but they go for choke points. And the choke points tend to be the heads of the Intelligence Committee, people like Mike Rogers and Dianne Feinstein. They will focus, and they will co-opt, and they will turn these people from critical scrutiny into advocates. They'll turn these people into mouthpieces for them, kind of sales reps almost. And you'll notice that Rogers and Feinstein have been some of the strongest defenders of these programs. And
Yes, they have.
So it makes sense. That's exactly what their technique is. They hone in and they say, these are people we need to get over on our side, and they find a way to do it. my guess is by somehow offering resources and support to these people, and ultimately purchasing their support. But like I said, this whole thing about the big lie, this is kind of something that Otis Pike found out. He was a Democrat representative from New York. And he was charged with investigating the intelligence services back in the mid-1970s. In 1974, Seymour Hersh had published an article in the New York Times talking about the CIA's Operation Chaos. And that's kind of spurred a lot of things. It spurred the Church Committee, which actually published its report, and it spurred the Pike Committee, too. The problem is the Pike Committee its scrutiny was a little more intense, and it made the government uncomfortable enough that they wouldn't declassify the report. They wouldn't allow them to release it, although some of it did leak out to the Village Voice. But what Pike found in a nutshell was that, it wasn't just one bad apple in the barrel. This is kind of a narrative that's being pushed forward. Well, you know what? The NSA is doing crazy things, but it's all Keith Alexander's fault. This is a technique that's being used to diminish the level of compromise that's happened. They're saying, well, it's just Keith Alexander, so if we get rid of him, we'll be okay. But the truth is that the NSA and the CIA are both obedient arms of the executive. There's no doubt about it that they do what they're told to do, and they're told to do it by the executive branch. And so what Pike found was that it's not just one bad apple in the barrel. It's the whole barrel that's bad.
I've got you. Well, we're coming to the end of the program. But, Bill, London, thank you very much, Arthur Behold of Pell Forest. My gosh, this hour is packed full of great information, and it's going to help us hold on to our liberties and freedoms. And we certainly thank you for being with us this evening.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, and I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
Good night.